Fully Loaded Chew is tobacco-free, long cut, and pouches that gives you the same pack, dip, spit, and buzz that you're used to without tobacco. Fully Loaded Chew comes in 9 flavors and is made with all food-grade ingredients and tobacco-free nicotine, the purest form of nicotine there is. To give us a try, head on over to fullyloadedchew.com for a $1 can of chew with free shipping when you enter the code OUTDOOR1. OUTDOOR and the number 1. Lastly, many outdoorsmen are trying to quit tobacco altogether, and Fully Loaded Chew may be that first step. For more information on our product line, visit fullyloadedchew.com.
You're listening to the Average Conservationist podcast, brought to you by Go Hunt and in partner with 2% for Conservation. Sign up today to become an insider at gohunt.com. 2% for Conservation's mission is to create an alliance of businesses and individuals that ensure the future of hunting and angling by committing their time and dollars to fish and wildlife. 1% of your time plus 1% of your money equals 2% for Conservation. 2% helps businesses and people pair with conservation causes to support things that fit what they care about. Whether you're into fishing, hunting, or just getting outdoors, 2% can help you not only start giving back to wildlife, but get certified for it. Getting 2% certified means you've made the same commitments as popular brands like Sitka, First Light, Stone Glacier, and Seek Outside in giving at least 1% of your time and dollars back to wildlife. But it's not just for outdoor companies. Breweries, contractors, coffee roasters, and even piano repair companies have earned 2% certification and stand out as leaders in their community for doing so. Businesses that are committed to conservation deserve your business when you shop. Learn more about 2% for Conservation at fishandwildlife.org. That's fishandwildlife.org. Ladies and gentlemen, happy Thursday. Welcome to another episode of the Average Conservationist podcast, and I'm your host, Marcus Ewing. Today on the podcast, I am joined by Brian Cooper, and Brian is a newly appointed committee member for 2% for Conservation, and Brian is doing a ton, and I mean a ton, of awesome work in the field of conservation. Brian and I kind of kick things off talking about what he does for a living, which is actually really cool, and he goes into some pretty good detail about what he does with his business, Red Tail Consulting, down there in Georgia. From there, he kind of tells some stories about, you know, how he really got introduced to the outdoors. A very funny story, really, in hindsight, about kind of what piqued his interest into the outdoors, nature, and really how everything kind of coexists together and how things in nature need one another to survive and to thrive. So really cool with that. And then obviously from there, we get into, you know, more of the conservation side of things, and really what Brian is doing down there in Georgia with his different work through Ducks Unlimited, NWTF, and then as well as the positions that he holds on a few different boards with Partnership for Conservation and then the Southern Conservation Trust. You know, Brian has a really good outlook on conservation, how it's so easy for each person to really do their part, and, you know, how all of these little changes, these little acts to better the environment, to better, you know, wildlife, the outdoors, how, you know, if everyone just does their part, it can make this huge monumental impact and really shift the way things are headed. So episode 59, Brian Cooper, enjoy. But before we get into the episode, I want to take a minute and tell you about our friends over at Wild Rivers Coffee. Sammy and Marshall, who I would just like to say real quickly, congratulations on the newest addition to their family. Super happy for them. But Sammy and Marshall are also the owners of Wild Rivers Coffee. And if you guys have not, please, please, please go out and give this coffee a try. It is awesome. Since I had Sammy and Marshall on the podcast months ago, before they ever became partners or that was ever a topic of conversation with them, I have been drinking their coffee. I know for sure switched some of my family over to drinking the coffee as well. It's that good. And you know what they're doing in terms of giving back to conservation and what their kind of mission and their goal is and their whole outlook on wildlife and the outdoors is awesome. At Wild Rivers Coffee, they're roasting in small batches, so they ensure that your coffee arrives at its peak freshness. Wild Rivers is also a proud partner with 2% for Conservation, and they believe in preserving the wild places and the wild things that bring all of us so much joy. That's why with everything they sell, a portion of the proceeds are being donated back to conservation organizations that are near and dear to them. So conservation organizations like Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Ducks Unlimited, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and Trout Unlimited. Go to wildriverscoffeeco.com to be sure and order your fresh roasted beans. They've got super cool handmade mugs, some really cool merchandise. They've got a ton of different accessories that you can use for grinding your own coffee, for pour over, for all that good stuff. Also, if you use the code, this is all caps, fish_wildlife, you're going to save 10% off your order. And right now, through the end of the summer, they actually have a promotion going on. So if you order their bundle, which is one of each of their different type of brand, if each of their different types of coffees, you're going to save 10% on that as well, whether you use the promo code or not. But again, that promo code at checkout is all caps, fish_wildlife. And again, you can check them out at wildriverscoffeeco.com. All right, joining me today on the podcast, I have new 2% committee member, Brian Cooper. Brian, how are you, man?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Really excited to be here and be a part of this great podcast.
Oh, well, thank you so much. No, I'm glad that we could make this happen. I know Jared just made the introduction. Late last week or something like that.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so, and you were super responsive. A lot of times when we make introductions, sometimes people are like, oh, you know, I'm free in a month or something like that. But no, I'm super excited that we were able to kind of get this on the books right away.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an honor to be on and, you know, share our stories and try and move our common goal of conservation forward in whatever way we can.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a while, honestly, since I've had a committee member on. A lot of the most recent guests have been either business owners or affiliated with 2% businesses. So when we first started the podcast, one of the things that we liked, or that Jared and I kind of talked about was, you know, with 2%, it's, you know, it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things in the world of conservation.
Right.
So to kind of set the stage for that, what is it that you do for a living, Brian?
So I have my own consulting business called Red Tail Consulting, and I've spent the last 15 years in the film and TV business, doing various things from running and operating a company that leased lighting and grip equipment. So if you ever see a movie set and all the lights that you see all over it, a lot of those came from my company. And my most recent project is I was the first employee for Pinewood Studios down here in Fayetteville, Georgia, which a lot of people may or may not be familiar with Pinewood, but if you like Marvel films, just about every Marvel film for the past 8 years was filmed in Pinewood Studios. So spent 6 years with them, and then went out, branched out, and started my own company where I try and take Georgia-based companies and hook them up with the film industry because they have goods and services that'll be useful and just don't know how to make that connection because it's kind of a different industry coming into Georgia. So yeah, I've been doing that about 2 years and really enjoying it.
So how did you get started, I guess, working in like the film industry like that? Is that what you went to school for?
No, it was actually kind of dumb luck. I worked for a company that I actually did commercial industrial lighting sales. And one of the big parts that I did was actually when LED and T8 fluorescence started coming out, we would go in and sell big warehouse complexes to go from the metal halide and the high pressure sodium lights to a more efficient and environmentally friendly light. Well, we were very successful and had a publicly traded company come in and purchase our company. And as happens a lot of times, they said, thank you very much to the executive team. And we've got it from here.
Yeah. So, been there before.
My roommate at the time was in commercial real estate and called me one day and he said, hey, I got a guy that's starting a lighting company in Georgia, but it's not the lighting that you did. And he's looking for someone to run it. I said, well, you know, what kind of lighting is it? He said, movie lighting. And I remember to this day thinking, well, that's strange because they don't film movies in Georgia. But I kind of piqued my interest. I went and met with the guy, learned a lot about a tax incentive that had just been signed in the state of Georgia, which was going to drive business here. And it was an established company out of LA, and he was opening up the branch in Atlanta. So took kind of a gamble and started it. And I really enjoy building things. So we actually had our last interview sitting Indian style on the floor in the warehouse that he had just rented. So I like that and say, okay, well, what do we do from here? So it started from there and just love the industry. It's a different industry. And it was a fun industry to kind of bring my passion for conservation and the environment in as well, because it's such a wasteful industry, and it's not on purpose. They consume so many resources doing a film. And so I spent a lot of my time working with their groups as far as how we can decrease their consumption, how we can do things, how I could do things at Pinewood as a facility to help meet some of their goals that were sitting down from corporate to be net zero, which I don't know if any movie has ever been net zero, right, after seeing how much they consume without buying offsets. But it really was just kind of dumb luck, and didn't have to go to LA, which there's nothing wrong with California for the listeners out there. I love it. I was actually born in Santa Monica, but at this point in my life, I love Georgia and was happy to stay home.
Yeah, no, Ed, that is a crazy story. And I feel like a lot of people's careers or when there's kind of this big shift in careers, you're still in the lighting business, right, or in that industry, just obviously like a different application, like you said,
right?
But it's those kind of happenstance occurrences when it really kind of pays the biggest dividends.
It really does. And really, the shift from the lighting company to Pinewood was simply I came down to call on Pinewood. I wanted to be a vendor, and the development team and the team that was financing it took a liking to me, and we started talking. And a few months later, I was hired as the first employee. And when it started, it was about a 100-acre wheat field, and now it's the second largest studio in North America. So, wow. Really proud of what we were able to accomplish there, and that. And you know, after 6 years, it was just time for me to let's see what the next thing is.
So is that where they were shooting a lot of the Marvel movies then, was down there at that studio?
Oh, yeah. So our first one was Ant-Man, and then we did Captain America Civil War, both of the Avengers Endgame, kind of the two that were back-to-back, Infinity Wars and Endgame, were filmed there, Ant-Man and the Wasp. I mean, really, Marvel found a home at Pinewood, and there was already a relationship because Pinewood's an international brand. It actually was started in London 80 some odd years ago. And so there was that relationship, but yeah, they found a home, and still to this day, they're there. The studio has, the ownership group has bought out the Pinewood section of it, and now it's called Trillith Studios. But yeah, there's still a lot of filming going on, and it's really made a big impact to the community that I live in. Obviously bringing that many people and that much, those many dollars spent into a smaller, you know, our county has about 200,000 people total. So okay. It's not that big, and it's made a big difference.
Yeah, no, I'd imagine when you start bringing in movies with the likes of the ones that you just listed off, yeah, that's going to bring, yeah, a lot of economic growth, I would say, to the area, which, I mean, like you said, can be, you know, a good and bad thing, but for a smaller community, especially, I would imagine a lot of, you know, mom and pop type shops and businesses that are in the area with a smaller community. So I'd imagine that things like that just, you know, are a benefit to the, yeah, the local income there, the local economy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it doesn't hurt that you can be having dinner and look over and see Pierce Brosnan or somebody, Chris Pratt, sitting over there having dinner next to you. It's kind of neat too.
Yeah, no, that would be real cool. So how much were you able to kind of be involved like while they were shooting, or is it just kind of you would supply them with the lighting and the different things that they needed, and then you kind of took a step back and worked on other projects?
Well, when with the company with the lighting, it's just what you said. You know, you kind of supply them, you do the deal, you make sure that that everything is working properly and maintain it. Once I went to Pinewood, it was more of an operations thing for the facility. So you're not involved in the production. You know, they come in and they're very self contained. They'll come in and they know what to do. You're there to support them. You're there to help if they want to utilize part of the facility in a way that maybe it was intended or not intended to, then you work through that, or, you know, just make sure that everything's operating at maximum capacity and efficiently for them. And really, you know, most groups that come in and make movies, they're pretty good at what they do. And,
yeah.
You know, they're you just kind of want to get out of the way and just make sure that that they're happy, because they're going to make it. And it's a high stress environment. I was there to try and de-escalate some of the stress if I could.
Sure. Yeah, no, that makes total sense. Now, when you transitioned over a few years ago and started Red Tail Consulting, is that basically just getting more people like your previous company involved in in the movie space, in the film industry, or is it not just like from the lighting side of things, but, you know, really kind of anything that goes along with potentially, like, you know, production and things like that?
Yeah, exactly. It's really anything that goes along with it. And the core purpose is that the state of Georgia has a tax incentive, and that's what's driving a lot of the business here. It's a 30% tax incentive or tax rebate that is transferable. And it works in Georgia because there's a lot of big business here. You've got Home Depot, you've got Chick-fil-A, you've got Coca-Cola that can actually buy large tax rebates. And as an individual, I can go out and buy tax credits at 86 cents on the dollar or whatever it's trading at now. But what really drives that and makes that incentive economically viable for the state of Georgia is the spend that these movies have need to be in the state of Georgia. They don't need to be resourcing or sourcing a product from California that doesn't help the state of Georgia when they can source that same project here. And so my idea was, there's a lot of companies that are Georgia-based, small, big, what have you, that have a good or a service that will work well in the industry. And I just wanted to bring those together so it strengthens the spend that they're making in the state of Georgia and ultimately will sustain that tax credit for years to come.
Okay. All right. No, that makes total sense then, is essentially kind of in a nutshell, keeping a lot of that industry, a lot of that money that's being spent right there in Georgia instead of trying to pull from other states or things like that.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
All right. Well, that's a super cool industry to be into or to be in, because, yeah, I mean, just the different types of companies that you work with that offer those goods and services that maybe you otherwise would not have an opportunity to get involved with, to know kind of what they offer or what their business model really is in terms of, you know, again, what they're supplying. But then being able to obviously help them grow their business, that's super cool.
Yeah, exactly. And then you never know what they're going to ask for. I mean, I would get calls from production sometimes. I got a call one afternoon that they needed a half a cow. And I thought, okay, interesting. So I had to go to work, and through some phone calls and stuff, I was able to source that for them. But then it turned into they needed a goat. So, you know, it's just one of those things that the industry is so ever changing, and that's exciting about it, that you never know what to expect when you go in.
So is it like the production, like the studio, that's actually calling you then to be like, hey, this is what we're looking for, what can you help us with?
The way it works is, like, you have a big, you know, what you call the studios, the big four out in California that are producing this, like Marvel's part of Disney, and then they have a production team that's on the ground, and they run the show on the ground. And then through that, it's just like any other organization, that it's split up into departments with department heads. So you have a multitude of people. A large production like Marvel could have 1,000 people working for it, and each department will call when they need something, and not necessarily for everything. I mean, they source their own products, and there we, as the studio facility, were there again to make sure that the facility was up to their standards and what they needed. But also, if they did come across something that they couldn't find, we were the locals. So, you know, we had the local knowledge, and they would reach out. So generally, when we got a call to source something, it was always something that was odd. and they just had no idea because they had never sourced it before. So just like any other organization out there, you know, big business.
Yeah, and I'd imagine if they were getting a hold of you because they couldn't find something, it was probably super last minute. They had probably exhausted all their resources. So you were then put under the gun, like, hey, I need you to find half a cow and a goat by, like, you know, by 8 a.m. tomorrow morning, and it's, you know, it's 5:30 on a Friday. So it's
usually
like,
usually it would be 5:30 on a Friday. They needed to buy 6:15 the same Friday, but yes.
So did they need the half a cow and a goat for, like, food for craft services or something like that then?
No, they were actually using it in a scene. It was for a scene that was going to be kind of post in the credits for Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Oh, post apocalyptic type scene.
Yeah, well, actually, it was, if I remember correctly, I think it got cut. I think it was two cavemen that were fighting over food, basically. And so I asked them, I said, all right, can we, you know, obviously this is kind of what would be considered a prop. Can we actually utilize this in some way after the scene? So they did, in fact, give it to craft service to cook up some tasty vittles after they were done with the scene.
Yeah, well, like, so, you said, no waste.
Exactly. Being respectful to the animal itself. So
yeah, definitely. All right, so we've kind of we have the let's call it the baseline established, what it is that you do for a living and what kind of sets you apart in the conservation world. So let's jump right into, you know, more of the fun stuff, the outdoors. So When was it that you were kind of first introduced to the outdoors?
You know, my story is a little bit different than a lot. you know, I've listened to a lot of the guests that you've had come on, and I really didn't grow up in an outdoor family. My parents just weren't. My dad was not an avid hunter. I actually don't think my dad's been hunting a day in his life. Maybe a little fishing, but I was put in a position that I was lucky enough that I had friends that were good friends that did come from families that were avid outdoorsmen. So at a very young age, I started getting invited to go, you know, deer hunting, turkey hunting, what have you, dove hunting, and really just kind of fell in love with it. I can remember as far as, you know, taking the hunting aspect of it, but just the part that I really felt a connection to nature and really wanted to be a part of it and how the world worked. I remember being in fifth grade and I was sitting there and we were in science class and we were talking about things that were biodegradable. And as a fifth grader, we don't think that well with our heads. Sometimes we're learning. And I had an itch in my ear, and, you know, kids now probably don't know what this is, but, you know, the old number two pencils that had the little metal thing on the end and then the eraser in there. Well, I used that to scratch my inner ear and the eraser popped off.
Oh, geez.
And I couldn't get it out. So I raised my hand. My teacher, she called on me and I said, are erasers biodegradable? And she kind of thought for a minute and she was like, well, yes, I think it would take a substantial amount of time, but yeah, they're biodegradable. So I thought, cool, it'll biodegrade in my ear. I'm not worried about it. So about a week later, my mom's walking past my bathroom of the house and I'm up on the sink kind of looking in the mirror at my ear. And she said, you know, Brian, what are you doing? I said, well, I got an eraser in my ear, but, you know, don't worry. It's cool. It's biodegradable. And she lost it. She, you know, straight to the emergency room, got it out. And at that point, it had actually worked itself into my ear to the point where the doctor said, you are about a centimeter to getting surgery. If it would have gone a little bit further down. So,
oh, wow.
But it really kind of opened my eyes to how the different things worked. And it really was a matter of, okay, so the homeostasis and kind of looking at this works with that and this in the natural world. I was also introduced to the outdoors through scouts. You know, I was not an Eagle Scout. My troop fell apart, but I was very involved from a young age in getting out and the hiking aspect and the camping aspect and starting to learn respect for our natural community. So that was pretty impactful to me. And that was when I kind of made the transition from what I would consider being a consumer of the outdoors just going out and almost being selfish about it. You know, I'm enjoying the outdoors, but I realized that I wasn't giving anything back. So, you know, the big campaign that the Leave No Trace, that's still around today and it'll be around forever. That was the first thing that I experienced that I thought, okay, it's my job to do something for the environment rather than just take from the environment. And that really was kind of my initial years of becoming a conservationist and learning what it meant and learning how to live in one with the natural world.
So if you got, or so, okay, so you got started, thankfully through some friends who had families that grew up kind of in the outdoors, that were, like you said, you know, avid outdoorsmen, outdoorswomen, their family. So how, or at what point, I mean, did you start hunting at that young age, let's say, or was it just more of just outdoor activities and spending, you know, time, like you said, when you were with the scouts, you know, hiking and camping and just learning more about the outdoors?
It was actually hunting. You know, they would take me out down here in the South. I grew up in South Carolina. Okay. And down here in the South, opening day of dove season is, it's like church. You know, everyone changes everything that they're doing for opening day of dove season. And so I started getting invited year after year to go to a dove hunt. Then got to be closer with different people, and they saw that I really had an enjoyment of that. And so then started getting invited to go deer hunting. So it was a lot of actually going out and in the hunting world, which is what I truly fell in love with. I mean, I love going on hikes and I love camping and all that stuff, but really getting out and everything that goes into the hunting world is what I became passionate about and fell in love with.
Yeah. And I've heard some cool stories about dove hunting and how it is. Yeah. It's kind of this, you know, this holiday, this national holiday for a lot of areas where dove hunting takes place. I've never personally done it, but it looks fun because it reminds me a lot of, like, you know, I'm here in Michigan, and, you know, when we have like opening day of rifle season for deer hunting, it's kind of this,
right,
this big thing. I mean, you know, depending on the area you live in, I mean, they'll close down schools for the day. But it's always like this big kind of coming together of, you know, friends and family for deer camp. You know, sometimes, you know, there's deer camps where, you know, a group of 5 or 10 people get together and heck, they may not even hunt, or maybe only one or two guys are actually hunt. It's just kind of the camaraderie of the whole thing, just the being able to come together and spend a few days, you know, in a remote area, kind of unplugged from, you know, your day-to-day, you know, hustle and bustle, if you will. But with dove hunting, it seems like it's probably a little bit different because, one, it's, you know, dove hunting seems to happen in a lot, you know, nicer climates than November in Michigan. But, you know, I don't know. Dove hunting, obviously, is just, it's a whole different ball game than, you know, whitetail hunting.
It definitely is. And I wouldn't say a nicer environment because it happens in September generally, and it is hot in September in the South. Yeah. But it is exactly what you're saying. It's the same as opening day of rifle season. And generally you go on a dove hunt and you could have 30 to 50 to 100 people there, depending on the size of the field. And up until recently, they just changed the law in Georgia. On opening day, you couldn't enter the field until noon. So you would get there early, you would have a big barbecue, a lot of that camaraderie and just catching up with people. And you'd see people that maybe you hadn't seen since last year's dove hunt, and kind of catching up, and then also going out in the field. And at a younger age, it was also one of the things that kind of introduced me to, you know, regulations and things, because a dove is it's a migratory bird. So it's not listed under the state resources, it's under federal resources. So learning a little bit about the differentiation between that too was kind of interesting as growing up. But, and a dove popper is probably one of the best things that you could have, where you take a dove breast, take a jalapeno, cut it in half, put some cream cheese in it, put the dove breast on top of it, wrap it in bacon, throw it on the grill, and it's pretty amazing.
That doesn't sound too bad, I'm not gonna lie. I mean, I've done that with pheasant before, but not with dove. But I'd imagine that they're probably, you know, similar in taste. I mean, they're similar style birds, but no, that especially, you know, if you are able to kill a mess of doves. I mean, that's enough food to, yeah, like you said, feed 50 to 100 people.
Yeah, and if you think about it, the limit on doves is 15 per person. So,
oh, geez. Yeah.
So you have plenty to cook afterwards, for sure.
Yeah. So now, as you started at that young age, and then you kind of got into high school and into college. So was hunting something that stayed with you all that time, or did the normal high school, college type things kind of get in the way? And whether it was sports, just friends, just wanting to be a teenager, a young adult. How did that kind of look for you?
It actually became one of the central aspects of my life. So as I got older, especially into the teenage years, and I played sports, football, baseball, never did basketball, was never good at it, but hunting became one of those centralized aspects. And in my formative years, I didn't really know why, but I was just drawn to be out there. I was lucky enough that as I got a little bit older, I had the opportunity to hunt at a club that was very close to my high school. And so turkey has always kind of been one of those things, just the spring and chasing turkeys. It gives me goosebumps just thinking about it now, even though we're just coming out of turkey season. But we would go and we would hunt daybreak every morning of the season. And then we would leave and we'd go straight to school and still be in our camouflage, be on time for school. Nowadays you could not do this, but we had our weapon, we had our shotguns in the car, half of them, were visible. Obviously you can't do this. We're talking, I graduated high school in 1995, so early 90s, but we would go to school. After school, we'd head back to the club and hunt in the afternoon and the evening, try and do a little bit of homework, in there to keep our parents happy. But it kept progressing that it truly was something that I was building my essence of a human being around.
Yeah, no, that's the times were certainly different in the early 90s, early and mid 90s, in the way that firearms were looked at.
Because
I grew up in a rural community in northern lower Michigan, and it was a lot of the same ways. I mean, a lot of my friends, I would say if you didn't participate in the outdoors in some way, shape, or form, that you were probably in the minority. It was just the way things were done. And like I said, our school closed down on opening day of rifle season. And I mean, there was obviously some safety concerns that went along with that, but a lot of kids wouldn't show up, either way. So, to hear about, just other parts of the country, in the South where, things are looked at, were looked at in the same way is pretty cool to hear, because, you can't always kind of compare, regions in terms of how the outdoors is looked at.
Right, right. And then we didn't close down for opening days of specific things, but luckily I had a supportive enough parents that I will say that I may have been allowed to stay out of school on certain days. We'll just, just leave it at that.
Yeah, those parents, yeah. Kudos to those guys for kind of seeing the big picture and seeing the long game at an early age.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you're heavily involved with hunting and the outdoors, through high school, through college. So at what point did you kind of have that shift where you're like, okay, I'm going to start volunteering my time now. I'm going to start giving back more. I know you mentioned earlier that you were still, or that, when you had the incident with the eraser that kind of, opened your eyes a little bit and made you start exploring and researching a little bit more. But, now that you're, into your adulthood and, you can kind of take the bull by the horns a little bit more, so to speak, what was it or when did you start becoming more actively involved in giving back and trying to do your part?
I would say that it really kind of, the beginning of it started in college, where I went to the University of Tennessee, and we had a University of Tennessee Ducks Unlimited chapter that I got involved in, was the chairman at one point. And at that point, as a college student, you look at as coming into an adult, you look at the things you have to offer. And I've heard guests say on your podcast before, it's time, talent, treasure. And obviously in the college years, the treasure was minimal, especially when you have to at some points decide whether you're going to eat or you're going to go out with your friends on that night. So didn't have a lot of money to give back, but I realized very quickly that I've got time. I've got time that I can give back. And there are certain talents that I had. I always had a propensity that I loved people. I loved networking and doing those things. So I kind of took that time with Ducks Unlimited and said, you know, this is something that I need to do more of. And this is me giving back. This is me when I go out into the field that I'm, again, I'm not just taking from the natural environment. I'm doing everything I can to give back and to find that balance. So through college, really involved in Ducks Unlimited and kind of kept that same mentality. You know, obviously we get out of college and, you know, I wasn't one of those lucky ones that just first job out, I wasn't making a ton of money, but I still had time. You know, everybody has the same amount of time. You got 24 hours in the day and it's a matter of how you choose to spend that time. And I started spending more and more of that time volunteering, getting involved, almost to the point where it was in excess after college. All of a sudden I'm involved in so many different things that was like, all right, there are other things that, you know, I want to be doing. So I had to kind of trim that down and get more focused on where I wanted to spend my energy. And that's where land conservation and habitat restoration really started coming into play, kind of in my, I'd say mid-20s to late 20s. And since then I've kind of been full bore. That's my passion. That's what I want to do. That's the legacy that I want to leave. I don't care about having my name on a building. I don't care about making all this money. Obviously, we all like to make money, but after my time, I want to leave the legacy of what I could have done for the land or what I did do for the land.
Yeah, and that's a great way to look at it, is because a lot of people, I think in the back of their mind, they always have this idea of what you just said, right? What their legacy is going to be. And, you know, different strokes for different folks. You know, some people do want that name on the building, right? For whatever reason. I mean, no shame to them, because again,
absolutely.
But to have that realization that, you know, I want my legacy to be what it is that I did for, you know, for the outdoors, for the common good, really, of everyone. Because, you know, for the most part, in any way, shape or form, that people are using the resource of the outdoors to some capacity, right? And to be able, or to say that, you know, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I plan to leave my mark, really for the betterment of other people and not for yourself, I think is awesome. And it really, you know, just speaks volumes to the character that you have and the vision that you have, you know, for the outdoors for the future.
Yeah. And really, if you look at it, you know, you take it a little bit further than just those that utilize the outdoors for camping, hunting, fishing, what have you. Our natural environment is important to every single person on this planet. It is everything from the way our habitat is and the way that the world can actually heal itself with carbon sequestration. And just, I mean, look at photosynthesis. The air that we breathe, that every person on this planet breathes, comes from things in the natural world. So it's much greater than just the hunting population or the angling population. And I grew up in a Christian family, and, you know, still am. And I truly believe that the natural world is a gift that was given to us, and we have a responsibility to be a good steward to that. And so that's kind of my overarching purpose to go in there. It's just like, if someone gives you a gift, you know, whether it be a new shotgun or something like that, your job is to take care of that. And if you don't, it's not going to work. It's not going to function. So just putting that on a larger scale and really looking at the outdoor world. And then this is going to sound a little crazy, and you may remember this movie, but there was a Pauly Shore movie called Biodome.
Yeah, for sure.
And the whole premise was that they stumbled upon this research facility that was really trying to create homeostasis and solve all the environmental problems and stuff. And Pauly Shore and his buddy came in and wrecked it, like in a day or two. I mean, just absolutely wrecked it. And then through them having a realization of what they had done, they actually worked and fixed it. And they were able to achieve the goal of whatever time it was. And even though it was a comedy and it was supposed to be campy, it really is kind of a powerful message that we as humans have come into this gift and we have wrecked it. You know, it's not, we can still salvage it, but we have come in and we are Pauly Shore coming into Biodome, and it is our responsibility to actually to see what we can do to fix it. So not the movie that most people would say had an impact on their on their beliefs, but it did for me.
Yeah. I haven't heard the movie title Biodome in, no joke, 20 years. So I appreciate you bringing that back up.
And you watch. You're going to watch it within the next couple of weeks. You're going to sit there one day and be like, I have to go back and watch that. So
yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, searching Netflix, searching Amazon Prime. I know this movie's got to be out there somewhere. Where can I watch it for free, right?
Exactly.
So kind of taking that one step further, you know, you recently became a committee member for 2% for Conservation. So how was it that you first learned about 2%?
I can't pinpoint it, whether it was a pop-up ad or something on Instagram or Facebook or whatever, but I saw it and I went to the website and started reading about it. And at first it didn't make sense, because I was like, wait a minute, I can sign up for free and I get this cool sticker and I'm already giving 1% of, you know, my income and way more than 1% of my time, to this. But it really kind of hit me. It was like, this is what people need. They need that motivation to kind of say, hey, I can do this. And they may already do it, but it gives them something tangible that they can really work towards and say, this is why I'm working towards it. I'm a member of 2% for Conservation. I've made a commitment to give 1% of my income and 1% of my time back to conservation efforts. And being involved in different conservation organizations, it's not a competing organization. And not that all the conservation organizations are competing necessarily, but they are kind of going after money in the same pot. So they go after people that they want to have people that'll give money at a Ducks Unlimited banquet and also give money at National Wild Turkey Federation. But I thought it was really cool that 2% was like, says, do that. You don't have to give us any money, you know, as an individual member. We just want to help you track it. We want to help you give you the resources through the committee members and different programs that are there. So it just seemed like the coolest idea in the world to me. And then I'd been a member for maybe, I don't know, 2 years, a year. I joined pretty early on in the inception of the program, but I saw the committee member part of it. And I thought, you know, that's another way that I can give some time that correlates with what I'm already doing. That if someone needed help finding something in Georgia or the Southeast or whatever, that I can help them to find those organizations to volunteer and to give their donations to. So I think the sky's the limit for 2%. I think it's one of the greatest organizations that I've come across. And just really excited and really honored that, you know, I sent in the application and Jared reached out to me. We had a conversation and, we hit it off and here I am on the podcast. So, yeah. I love it.
Yeah. And I think one of the cool things and one of the things that separates 2% from a lot of other organizations is the accountability part of it. Right. I mean, because they're
absolutely,
you know, while an individual or a business can say that, yeah, I'm going to give, you know, the 1% of my time, the 1% of my money back, you know, there's nothing tracking it with some other organizations, right? They're like, I mean, well, with 2%, like, you know, when you first sign up, you know, if you're a new business or you're just getting started, like you're making the commitment, you're pledging that you're going to do this. And then, you know, periodically throughout the course of the year, you know, whether it's Jared, whether it's Calvin, you know, someone's checking in to say, you know, how are you doing with your time and money? You know, what have you been giving back to? So it's that accountability part that I feel like really separates it and really makes people want to stay active, to stay engaged, and to do the things that they said that they were going to do.
I agree 100%. And that accountability, I think that's part of the psychology of just human nature. you know, if you make a commitment to something, and that's honestly, it sounds silly, but that's kind of where the sticker comes in too. You put the sticker on your car, you put it on your water bottle, you put it on whatever, and it's that constant reminder. I made a commitment. So have I met that commitment? And there is that accountability. So I agree 100%.
Yeah, because the last thing you want to be, I mean, it's one thing for someone to, you know, see the sticker or see a t-shirt, see a hat that you might be wearing. And, you know, whether they're familiar with it or not, they're going to immediately associate you with whatever that brand or that logo is. And yeah, the feeling of kind of walking around as a fraud, I feel like as an individual, like if you're not actually doing what you said you were going to do, would kind of eat up at me, right? You'd almost be like living a lie. Like I said, absolutely. Oh yeah, like I'm giving back 1% of my time and 1% of my money. And you go home and look in the mirror like, no, you're not. Right. So yeah, that's that there's just, yeah. Like you just said, there's these little things that are constant reminders that help keep you accountable and, you know, essentially put the work in because, you know, for whether you're, you know, if you're a business to put in those 21 hours, it's a lot easier, right? Especially if you have, you know, five, you know, even if you just have 5 employees, you know, you can take your entire company out for a Saturday morning and boom, you've hit your 21 hours, right? But as an individual, you know, 21 hours is obviously more of a time commit. It's more of a commitment, but it's also still very, very attainable. And it's like you mentioned earlier on, you know, everyone has the same amount of time in the day. It's how you choose to spend it. And if you just, you know, make that conscious effort to say, okay, you know, this day I'm going to do this, this day I'm going to do that, next month, I'm going to volunteer with this. Like it, that 21 hours comes pretty darn quick.
It does. It does. And it's, you know, that commitment, like me personally, I try and make I have two different commitments that aside from the organizations I'm involved with, just personal commitments is, I want to have a long-term commitment to the environment and to conservation, and then I want to have a short-term commitment. And for me personally, my long-term commitment is I don't drink bottled water. You know, people can debate bottled water all they want, but it's a very wasteful industry. You know, 29 billion some odd people or bottles of water are consumed every year, and very little of that comes back into recycling. Just so many different things with it. So I carry a water bottle with me every day. So that's my long-term commitment. My short-term commitment is that every day of my life, I want to do one act that is positive for the environment. And that may be as simple as picking up a piece of trash, choosing when I go to a fast food restaurant and say, no, I don't need the utensils, you know, saying no to single use, just whatever it is. And I think that those things also lend to it that if we look at 328 million people just in the U.S. alone, if everybody in the U.S. did one thing every day, doesn't have to be a big thing. If everybody did one thing, we could have some pretty momentous shift in what's going on in today's society.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, it's one of the things I say when I sign off with a podcast, you know, I say conservation starts with you because, you know, it doesn't have to be this big rah-rah act or thing, I guess, that you do. It's as simple as, yeah, you're at the store, you're walking out to your car with your groceries or whatever, and someone, you know, candy wrapper on the ground, pop bottle on the ground, whatever it is, you know, pick it up, throw it in the trash, or put it in your car and then throw it in the trash when you get home, right? Like those little things go such a long ways in the long run that, you know, and it doesn't take any type of real effort, right? I mean,
no.
What, you bend over to tie your shoe once or twice a day, right? Bend over and pick up a piece of trash. I mean, that extra 3 calories that you're burning aren't going to hurt you, I promise.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one thing that really attracted me to the whole idea that you've started with the Average Conservationist is that's what it is. And I think that what we do for the environment, what we do for conservation, what we do for the world is a highly personal thing. And you just hit the nail on the head. It doesn't have to be this big rah-rah thing. I don't need anybody patting me on the back for doing this.
Right.
This is something that is personal to me that I'm going to make a difference in. And hopefully through that, somebody may see you do this. And it may make them think the next time that they're walking over a piece of trash, that they just pick up a piece of trash, throw it in there, that they make a conscious choice to do something to keep something out of our landfill. So that's the whole idea of grassroots. You know, let's start seeing more and more people do this, and then it becomes the norm.
Yeah,
and that's what we're really looking for.
Yeah, So now from a conservation side of things, what are some projects that you personally are involved in, whether it's kind of at a larger scale with maybe some national organizations or even, you know, locally there in Georgia that you're working on?
Right. So I serve on two boards that are focused on land conservation. The national organization that I'm on the board for is called Partnerships for Conservation. And really, we are a group that advocates positive legislation for land conservation. And there's been a lot of stuff in the news lately about syndicated easements and different things. And, you know, in the past, it's really been kind of conservation and land, doing conservation easements have really been kind of geared towards high net wealth individuals. So, you know, how do we put this down to your normal landowner that doesn't have a huge tax liability, but they can participate in this? So we work with senators in Washington, you know, the House. We work with Congress on positive legislation and just be an advocate for conservation. On the local level, I'm on the board of Southern Conservation Trust, and we are a land trust. So when I started on the board about 8 years ago, we had 1,600 acres under conservation. And now we're approaching roughly 75,000 acres.
Oh, wow.
We're in 11 states. We are very involved in other aspects of conservation, not just the simple, and not that it's simple, but doing conservation easements. We really focus on education. So teaching not just kids, which is important in the formative years, but also teaching adults, you know, how this whole thing works. You know, what is it that we're losing every minute? We're losing an acre of land to development. You know, what is it that is going to give our children, our grandchildren, our great grandchildren the same resources that we have now? So we've really focused on what that means in a holistic approach. And I really believe we're one of the few land trusts that do that, where it's not just focused on taking land and putting it under a conservation easement and conserving it in perpetuity, but we want every aspect of it. We want to teach. We want to have people that haven't experienced the outdoors actually get into the outdoors. We're one of the few land trusts that is truly pro hunting. You know, you get some land trust out there, they're like, hunting, no, that's a bad thing. Like, no, well, actually, there's a lot of science and a lot of data on why it's a good thing, not to mention the Pittman-Robinson Act, which puts, you know, has put $20 billion into conservation since the late 30s. So there's more than just that. And it's been a lot of fun. We've got an amazing team. We just opened up our, we just bought a nature center and an 1800s house here in Fayetteville. We've turned it into a nature center. We've got 14 acres around the nature center itself that we're turning into a botanical garden to really give back to the public. We do a lot of public parks here in Fayetteville. We've got 700 and some odd acres of public parks with trails and lots of different opportunities to get people outside. So those are the two big organizations I'm really involved with. And then, of course, aside from that, Ducks Unlimited and National Wild Turkey Federation, still kind of same mission, maybe, you know, species specific, but still the under all goal of everything that I'm involved in is conservation.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, just those, you know, being a member on the board of directors for those two conservation organizations that you mentioned, I mean, and the work that you guys are doing, I mean, hell, that sounds like, you know, a full-time job in and of itself, let alone, you know, having your own consulting business, you know, maybe the consulting business is on the side, you know, it's just funding all of the stuff that you need to do for these, you know, board positions.
And kind of to add to that, really a lot of this stuff is funding my love of the outdoors and being able to go out and experience this. So, yeah. You know, with what I do for a living, to fund that, what I do as far as volunteer on these boards, the ultimate goal is that I want to have a piece of land that I can go and enjoy what I really enjoy doing.
So with the Southern Conservation Trust, I mean, how is it that you guys are acquiring? I mean, you said you have land in 11 different states. So how are you guys kind of going about acquiring that land for conservation purposes or for easements?
So it's kind of twofold. We've built relationships over the past couple years of people that are large landowners that are looking for tax breaks. And, you know, anybody who says that conservation easements and stuff doesn't kind of really fall into the tax break, I'd like to have a conversation with them. But they and it's the way that I subscribe. Like, I'm a capitalist. Look, I'm all about people making money. You know, have at it. Do it within the constraints of the law and what's out there. It's great. And even if you look back to Aldo Leopold, you know, he shifted in his life from kind of his economics to where he really understood that to fund conservation, what we do in the Pittman Robinson Act is great, but we need private capital to fund conservation. And with what we've got going on now with this 30-30 initiative, wanting to conserve 30% or protect 30% of the land in the U.S. in the next 9 years, people don't realize we're only at 12% right now. If you look at the protected land in the United States of America, we're at 12%. So we've got a ways to go. And that's a significant amount of acreage. So we had relationships with landowners, and then we also became where word of mouth. We started getting calls from, like, we got a call from Colorado and they wanted us to do an easement out there. It's like, absolutely. You know, we're kind of one of those that don't, if it's got true conservation value and we see it as an opportunity, we're absolutely going to do it. And my goal, not necessarily our staff's goal and the rest of the board, but I'd love to see us everywhere. You know, I'd like to see us have be one of the first land trusts that's not just based in one geographic location. I'd love to have us have a satellite office, you know, on the West Coast or in the Midwest or what have you, that is taking care of these easements. But it's really just building that name. It's just like 2%. You know, over time, you start building that name. And when I first talked to Jared, he had actually heard of our land trust. And that really, it made me smile. I mean, I called our executive director right after. I was like, I just talked to this dude, Jared, from 2% Conservation, and he heard of us. You know, he's in Montana. We're in Fayetteville, Georgia. So we've through the past couple of years, and, you know, we don't do big marketing campaigns or anything like that. It's a lot of word of mouth. And doing the right thing and being easy to work with, and people know that they can come to us and trust us with what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, no, that's first off, yeah, if Jared's heard of you, you're doing something right, because he's definitely got his kind of ear to the ground when it comes to the conservation world. So yeah, to be essentially, you know, 2/3 of the way across the country and have him, you know who the land trust is and the work that you guys are doing. I mean, no, that definitely speaks volumes to the work, again, that you're doing. But I like what you said about, you know, the word of mouth and kind of organically growing, you know, the organization, and, you know, just this holistic approach, as you mentioned, to adding, you know, land and conservation easements, you know, across the country. Because, yeah, I mean, if you said we're at 12% now and we have, you know, 9 years, I mean, that's an uphill climb for sure.
Absolutely. And I think it's achievable. But it really, I think one of the key components to it is conservation organizations, which some of the largest ones are specialized in the hunting industry. Yeah, and right. Hunters do make up a large percentage of people that are involved in conservation and the dollars that goes into it. But Jared and I were talking about this recently. Just because you go out and buy a hunting license does not make you a conservationist.
Right.
That was something that was enacted before any of us were born. There's probably very few people that are still alive today that are still buying a hunting license. We're born in 1939 or 37 or whenever the act went in. So I think it's important to educate and promote not only in the hunting world, but the non-hunting world. And because it is important to all of us. And I don't mind driving it and being an avid outdoorsman and being part of the solution and driving it. But we need those, whether it be time, talent, treasure. But, you know, whatever you can give to conservation outside of the hunting world. And if we can find that, then I think we're making a big step forward, which is where, you know, honestly, you come in. I mean, the average conservationist is that's it. You don't have to be a sportsman. You don't have to, just the average everyday American can be a conservationist and make a positive impact on what we're all trying to achieve.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head there, and that's exactly like where, you know, the name for the brand and for the company kind of came from is there's, you know, there's a lot more people out there like you and I who are, you know, spending their off hours, their nights, their weekends, you know, whether it's just, you know, whether it's hunting, volunteering with different conservation organizations, whatever the case is, than people who are, you know, fortunate enough to kind of make a living as a conservationist, right? Or make a living, you know, as maybe, you know, a member on the board of directors for some of these organizations where, you know, they're actually, you know, paid positions or anything like that. And, you know, there's strength in numbers, right? So if there's more of us than there are of them, you know, we need to come together and we need, you know, our voices heard. And not that they're not, because I certainly think they are, but I kind of wanted to celebrate, you know, those people who, you know, don't necessarily need to, but want to, right? Like they feel right. that, like you mentioned earlier, they feel that kind of moral obligation to do the right thing with the gift that they were given of, you know, the land.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, how do you bring two different groups together that have the same underlying goal of right. conservation, but we may have different ideals about how to get there. You know, you have the non-hunters and the hunters, and sometimes they can be diametrically opposed with certain organizations. But if you strip all that away and look at what we're really trying to achieve, then there's ways that we can work together. And your average American has the time, has the talent, and has the treasure to give one of them to something to make a positive change.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, as we kind of wind things down here, I like to ask, and you've said you've listened to some episodes before, so you're probably familiar. I like to just, you know, kind of find out what people have in store for the rest of the year, if they have any big trips planned, any big hunts planned that they're excited about. So what do you have in store for the last half of 2021 here?
Shoot. Well, the last half of 2021, you know, obviously 2020 kind of disrupted a lot of things.
Yes.
But for me personally, I try and take a couple of trips a year. I try and go out to South Dakota in November to do a pheasant hunt. I try and go to Chesapeake Bay to do a duck hunt. And I do quail hunts early in the year, which will be next year. But it really is as a matter of kind of getting back on track after 2020, after the whole pandemic and all this, and then just figuring out what's next. We're in a big transitional period with conservation easements. And so a lot of my time is going to be spent fighting the good fight for that, you know, working with P4C and strengthening the integrity of our conservation easements on the national level and then on the grassroots level. You know, we've got a Southern Conservation Trust. We've got our banquet in September, you know, one of our big fundraisers of the year. So we've been doing some work with that, but really I'm the kind of person that any chance that I can get to get outside, I'm there. I gave up playing golf a long time ago, because if I got 4 hours to spend outside, I want to be in the woods. I don't want to be on a golf course. I want to be in the woods. And so, I'm really looking forward to getting back to South Dakota, to be honest. One of the members that we've gone out there for years passed away last year. And so this would be the first trip without him. And he was the one who always put it together. So that'll probably be a pretty special trip and an emotional trip as well, as this is a person that was in my life for 10 years. So yeah, that's kind of where I am and what I'm looking for the next half, and just trying to keep my head above water. That's what we're all trying to do right now.
Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, it sounds like between Chesapeake Bay and then South Dakota, I mean, those are some pretty pristine areas for, you know, waterfowl and for pheasants. So it sounds like some awesome trips for sure.
And I would love to. I've never hunted in Michigan. I would love
say
to
the
come
word,
to Michigan.
Man. Say the word. You want to?
And I'm a big fan of Michigan, because I'm a huge Hemingway fan. So okay. He's from Michigan.
Yep.
But it looks like a beautiful state, and you know, we might have to work that out this year.
Yeah, no, Michigan is, I feel like, and I'm sure this is, you know, mostly because I'm biased of being a, you know, a Michigan resident, born and raised here, but it's vastly underrated in terms of the outdoors. I mean, we have, you know, the Great Lakes, you know, we have the Upper Peninsula, you know, and there's just, you know, there's really something for everyone. I mean, if you want to, you know, hunt pheasants or quail or, you know, partridge, whatever. I mean, there's areas you can do that. I mean, tons of awesome trout streams. You know, turkey hunting isn't, you know, awesome, but I mean, there's still plenty of opportunity for that. The whitetail scene is, you know, it's hit or miss, but I mean, a lot, you know, there's plenty of people who kill, you know, plenty of good deer here every year. You know, if you want to get out on the big water with, you know, Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, you know, you want to catch some salmon or lake trout or anything like that, steelhead. I mean, yeah, there's something for everyone, man. So if you ever want to venture up this way, for sure, let me know. We'll get into something.
Oh, yeah. And I'm an avid fly fisherman. So the trout streams, and people don't think about Michigan when it comes to trout.
I know.
But everything that I've read is like there's some really world-class trout fishing in Michigan.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the Asable River, which is probably what most people know from Michigan. But there's a stretch on the Asable called the Miracle Mile, which is just, I mean, I can't even think of the statistics for how many fish are in like that stretch, but it's, I mean, it's ungodly. And I mean, you want to fish that either, you know, probably later in the fall, just because right. A lot of people have kind of gotten off the water and a lot of people are, you know, maybe spending more time, in the woods than on the river. But, yeah, no, I'm actually, heading to northern lower Michigan, next week for a little family vacation. So I'm hoping to actually get some time on the river to, do some fly fishing. So
nice. Nice.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I really appreciate you making some time, man. I really enjoyed speaking to you and look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Yeah, thank you again for allowing me to come on.
Yeah, absolutely. I enjoyed it, man. Well, take care of yourself and we'll talk soon.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks. All right. Well, thanks again to Brian for taking some time to join me on the podcast today. I would also like to thank the partners of the podcast, Go Hunt and Stone Glacier, as well as Wild Rivers Coffee Co. Please be sure to support the companies that support this podcast and help make it possible. I would also like to thank 2% for Conservation. And if you're interested in learning more about 2% for Conservation, you can visit their website, fishandwildlife.org. And there you can see all the certified brands that have committed to conservation that you should support when you shop. I also encourage you guys to give 2% a follow on social media, where they're going to post only positive conservation-driven content, so you'll definitely enjoy that in your feed. So again, if you'd like to learn more about 2% for Conservation, you can look for them online on social media or at fishandwildlife.org. Thanks for joining me this week, everyone. Hope you liked the episode. Remember, stay safe out there, and conservation starts with you.